Senate Environmental Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Members, the date is April 27th. The bills we're going to hear today are in general, actually, they're one, two, three. There's four more heritage bills, not leftover, but in order, that bills that we did not hear last night. So we'll start out with those four, and then I have a couple of bills that I actually have to combine, the Outdoor Heritage Fund along with the Clean Water Fund and one other small that's it. Senator Vanderveer's got another one. So with that, members, again, we're trying to limit this to not over 10-minute presentations. Sometimes they get a little longer, sometimes a little shorter, but we would certainly appreciate that. The committee did spend a lot of time last night till midnight or 12:15 doing these, so we'd like to make sure we get out of here in a decent time today. So with that, Senator Bonhoff, Senate File 1251. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grab a microphone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, appreciate being able to present this bill today. I am here with my neighbors and constituents, the Grahams, and I am bringing this bill before you as a potential solution to a pretty sticky problem. We all have, in our lives, experienced the downturn in the economy in different ways. I know for myself, the value of my home has dropped significantly. Many of us have experienced that and the repercussions of that fact. The people who are here before us today have experienced it in a way that is extremely tough. And when they brought their story to me as their state senator, I became quite concerned on behalf of the state. They were in a situation where they entered into an arrangement to sell their property to Parks and Trails, who was buying it on behalf of DNR. And I will let them tell you the story. I don't want to take the punchline. All I will tell you is that this story did not have a happy ending, and I think the ending as it stands today is unacceptable. I think it's unacceptable for us as lawmakers to just step aside and say, well, I'm sorry it turned out this way. I'm not sure of the right answer, but I do think that something needs to be done to right this situation. And so I want to thank several people who have gotten involved in this, in particular Senator Carlson, because of his proximity to the property in trying to solve this. But rather than go into more detail about the bill, I'd like to give the Grahams an opportunity to tell their story, and then I will conclude with how the bill addresses the problem, if that's acceptable to the committee.
That's fine. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I just, on behalf of my husband, Maury, and I would like to thank you for the time that you have allotted us this afternoon. My name is Debbie Graham. My husband is Maury Graham. We're lifelong residents of Minnesota. And until just recently, I have lived in the Brainerd Lakes area where the property that we are discussing here this afternoon lays. And we are both very active environmentalists, and we understand the importance of preservation of Minnesota resources. And the property that I have is about 17 acres in the Crow Wing State Park. The Crow Wing State Park is about 9 miles south of Brainerd. It's approximately 3,000 acres and encompasses the Mississippi River and the Crow Wing River. And the Crow Wing River is one of the most pristine natural rivers in the state of Minnesota. And I have about 1,000 feet on the Crow Wing River, and it's on a peninsula that has archaeological, environmental, and historical values that go not only from the Red River Oxen Trail that goes through it to 13 different animals, birds, plants that are on the endangered, threatened, or specific interest list. and it's some property that needs to be protected from development. And from there, I'll turn it over to my husband.
I have a question. I'm sorry, ma'am. You said the 17 acres were inside the park?
They are inside the park, okay. Yes.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Maury Graham, Deb's husband, obviously. When Deb realized in 2008, reluctantly, that she needed to sell the property, she was very excited about the prospect of the DNR acquiring the property. She did have a couple of private development suitors, if you will, that were very interested in the property. The property was zoned as such that 8 higher-end homes could be put in there. She got in touch with Parks and Trails and DNR. DNR told her categorically that they wanted the property, but that we needed to work through Parks and Trails. And it's our understanding at that time that the DNR flagged this property as a number one priority. Subsequent to that, a certified DNR appraisal was done. The appraisal came in, and the Parks and Trails made an offer to buy the property based on that appraisal, which we accepted. A couple of caveats to this that are extremely important is at the time Parks and Trails informed us that they didn't have the funds to pay for the entire piece of property before they could get reimbursed from the DNR. So Deb offered to give them a 4-year balloon contract for deed. Now, the thing that's very unusual about this contract for deed is because of their tight financial situation, she agreed to write the contract for deed at 0% interest, which, as everyone in this room knows, involves a lot of opportunity cost on money. The other thing that's extremely unusual is that we agreed at their request to give the DNR fee title for the first 2 parcels of property that they paid for prior to completing, prior to this contract for deed being completed. I think everyone in this room who's been involved with any kind of real estate transactions on a contract for deed would never give fee title based on a partial payment of property, nor would you give somebody 0% interest. So you're asking, why did we do it? We did it because we trusted them. We did it because Parks and Trails was an agent for the Department of Natural Resources. And we had no reason to believe that we were thrilled that this property was going to maintain itself in the Crow Wing State Park. We would never have cut this kind of a deal with a private purchaser, nor would anybody else in this room. So having said that, 2 parcels were allocated funding by DNR to Parks and Trails, and the rest of it, the first anniversary payment on the contract for deed was due December 31st of 2010. We received a phone call from Parks and Trails on or about the 1st of December 2010, informing us that their intent was to default on the contract for deed. You can't imagine how distressing this is because I've been in business for 40 years. I have never cheated anybody out of 5 cents. Deb's been in business for 30 years. She's never cheated anybody out of 5 cents. We honor our obligations. We've always honored our obligations to our customers, anybody that we've done business with. And we were shocked that an agent for the state of Minnesota could do this. We have every desire to have DNR own this property. We still do. But I think if we cannot get a favorable resolution to this, other options are going to be on the table, and the DNR will never own the property. So with that said, I'd like to thank Senator Bonhoeff and some of her colleagues in the Senate chamber, as well as some of her colleagues in the House of Representatives who have been very helpful in trying to get something resolved that is good for all parties. And that's all I have to
say. Thank you, Mr. Graham. The question I would have, a couple, I guess. What was the, you said there was an appraised value. Can you tell me what the appraised value was?
$1.2 million.
And what was the agreement, Mr. Graham, from the DNR? Were they going to pay that $1.2 million?
The Parks and Trails Council agreed to a purchase agreement, and Deb, the correct me if I'm wrong, the exact figure was $1,133,000.
That is correct, and they paid for the for two of the parcels outright, and then $100,000 down on the remaining three parcels for contract for deed, leaving a balance of $773,000.
So to understand it, there were some dollars exchanged.
Yes.
And the total dollars again was?
The total amount that was on the purchase agreement is $1.133 million. Parks and Trails Council purchased two lots and plus $100,000 down on the remaining three lots to do a contract for deed, leaving a balance of $773,000.
I would just like to interject that the reason why giving fee simple title on those two parcels you would never obviously do in a private transaction is because it depletes the value of the property for a developer. The economics of developing 17 acres is significantly more attractive than the remaining 10 acres. So effectively, the DNR now owns the end piece, the two parcels on the end. They effectively own the two parcels from Deb's neighbor, who we referred to the DNR on the other end, and this piece in the middle, it makes no sense. DNR effectively, if Parks and Trails and DNR does not honor this contract, they've wasted their money on the end piece over here and in the end piece over here.
Mr. Graham, that was going to be my next comment or question. If they default on the contract for deed, then they're going to be out the money. They own nothing. Is that correct?
If the Parks and Trails defaults on the contract for deed, they are out $100,000. And ostensibly, we take the property back.
Right.
Or we pursue litigation.
We take 10 acres back.
We take 10 acres, not 17. And that's why we never would have given them fee title on that first 7 acres. Never. We trusted them. We relied on them. And maybe we were just flat-out stupid and too trusting, and in hindsight, I guess we were. But we thought that an agent for the DNR we could trust.
So, Mr. Chair, one approach, and that's why the language was drafted this way, is by putting forward a bill that appropriates money from the Parks and Trails Fund to the DNR. That would allow the Parks and Trails people to be made whole because they are out the 100. There's a balance of the 773, so that's where you get to the 873. Now, we, you know, do not want precedent in state law to say somebody must pay this price for the land. So you'll see that isn't how this language is written. It appropriates the money to be used for that, but does certainly not complete a deal or tie someone's hands. But that is the intent.
Any questions? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, even though this is not my area, it feels like my area. It's in Cass County, which is Senator Carlson's, but I've actually walked on that property and visited with the people engaged here. And my understanding now is some of the regulations have also changed so that it can't be developed like it could have been developed before. Is that correct?
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Yes, you're correct in that because of the acreage that is remaining, we would not have the opportunity to develop that property as it once was. Now, what could go in there would be an RV park. I've already checked with Cass County to see if those avenues are available, which we could proceed forward with that. As far as what's remaining with the 10 acres, if we were to take that back, the maximum that could be put in there as far as a residential application would be 5 homes versus the 8 of what it was before.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to hear at all from Parks and Trail Council or from the DNR regarding this?
That would be my, if there's no further questions, we'll certainly give them a chance to come up if they're here. Somebody from the DNR wishing to testify? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Well, we do appreciate the testimony today. The issue before you is really not a DNR matter. We have not done any appraisals on the property. The acquisition and the contract for deed, all of the actions that have taken place today are between the Parks and Trails Council and the property owners. We do appreciate and support the work that the Parks and Trails Council does working with us. But they do that full well knowing that there's a risk involved, that if the market, the real estate market does depreciate, does crash, they are not going to receive more than fair market value for anything that they acquire on our behalf or on their own behalf. So we understand the situation that the landowners and the Parks and Trails Council are in, and we're very sympathetic to that. But to date, we have not done an appraisal. We're getting prepared to certify an appraisal on the first piece of the acquisition who works with the Parks and Trails Council on acquiring that piece, but that will be significantly less than the Parks and Trails Council paid the Grahams for that parcel to begin with. We are required by law to only offer appraised value, a little bit more in rare circumstances, but we acquire land at the appraised value at the time of acquisition. We're working with this. This is a piece that is of interest to us within the park boundaries, but there are a lot of pieces within park boundaries that are in holdings that are priorities for us as well. We want to try to work with both entities to make them comfortable as we can, but we need to work within a letter of law. The way the language is still written, it will not allow us to provide any more than fair market value or what the appraisal is on that property at today's date. So the 873, well, would be the market value or may be remaining or may not be remaining on a contract for deed agreement. We would still have to go in and appraise the value of the land, and then we would only be able to pay that amount. So, as I said, we're very sympathetic to the situation, and this isn't the only situation like this going on within the state. I know a lot of people who have houses that they've been trying to sell that continue to depreciate in value or own land, recreational land, seasonal rec land, that may or not be holding value right now. So it's an issue we're facing statewide and as a nation. So, Mr. Chairman, members, if there's no other questions, that's about all I can provide you on this issue.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Graham,
can I respond to that?
Certainly, real quickly.
I don't think there is one level-headed person outside of this room out in the state of Minnesota that doesn't believe that the Parks and Trails Council is joined at the hip with the Minnesota DNR. Their mission statement on their website delineates it quite specifically. They're a purchasing arm for the DNR. As ordinary citizens, when we contact the Minnesota DNR and they tell us, yes, we are very interested in purchasing your property, please go through the Parks and Trails Council, that tells me, and I think most logical thinking people, the Parks and Trails Council is an agent for the DNR. And this separation that they have, you know, contractually our contract is with Parks and Trails Council, but no one is going to convince us or anybody else who knows about this that Parks and Trails Council wasn't operating on behalf of the DNR. And we had an appraisal, and at the time this sale was consummated, no one from Parks and Trails told us that they reserved the right, or the DNR reserved the right, before any anniversary payments were made to go back and reappraise the property. Never. Or we probably wouldn't have done it.
On another note.
Real quickly, ma'am. Thanks.
On another note, all of the years that property values had appreciated, Parks and Trails would purchase property and sit on them, remain on them for 2, 3, 4 years. Property values appreciated. Then they'd turn around and get an appraisal with the DNR and sell them to the DNR at an appraised value that was higher than what they purchased it at, which cost the Minnesota taxpayers more money for the property than what it should have. And now when it's reversed, we're sitting here trying to get something, trying to get a resolution, and the DNR is washing their hands of it. Parks and Trails are washing their hands of it. And this is not how you treat Minnesota citizens.
Any further questions? Senator Monhoff.
Mr. Chair, that's why I began my testimony saying this doesn't have a happy ending at the moment. It is my intent to put this forward as a potential a way of solving this, and I defer to the committee that you'll have to grapple with this, but I don't think that the Grahams have been dealt with in a way that we ought to just say this is too bad, because the difference between what Mr. Myers was saying and their situation is it's not just an individual whose home value dropped. It's somebody who was in a contract with an agent of our state. So thank you.
Senator Dames, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if there's somebody from the Parks and Trails Council would like to respond or would respond.
I don't believe there is anybody here today.
Joe Bagnoli is coming.
I'm sorry, I guess there is. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Joe Bagnoli with the McGranche Law Firm on behalf of the Parks and Trails. I will actually begin by saying the executive director, as you know, this bill was introduced yesterday and scheduled some point yesterday. Our executive director was really unfortunately unable to be here today, who frankly knows the most about this issue and about purchasing policies of the Parks and Trails Council. I unfortunately am less able to answer. He's provided a letter. We've provided a letter that's essentially the testimony that he probably would have given. I believe it's in your – I see a few of you have it in your packets. So unfortunately, I'm a very unsatisfactory witness. I don't know who had the question.
Members, if you don't have any more questions, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bagnoli, is it true what we heard that the Parks and Trails would buy a piece of property from a citizen and at some time in the future when the DNR was ready, willing and able to purchase it from Parks and Trail Council, that they would do an appraisal at the new point in time and whatever that price was, or did those pieces of property get sold to the DNR at the price that was purchased by Parks and Trail, if I made that clear?
I am, Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I'm reluctant to answer that because I don't know the policies. I can tell you that the mission of the Parks and Trails is to get as much land into the Parks and Trails, as much land to be used for Parks and Trails. So I'm just reluctant to be on the record. I think I know the answer, but I do not. Been suggested that I do not offer too much comments on areas that I don't have that much experience.
Mr. Bagnoli, are there any other questions? I think we have to move on here. I certainly sympathize with the situation here. I'm not sure that we can play referee today. I would like to be able to do that, but I don't think that I know enough about the situation. The committee doesn't know enough about the situation to act on anything right now. And in defense of the Parks and Trails, which I can't, quite frankly, other than the letter, I'm just assuming that we can count on Parks and Trails folks visiting with Senator Bonhoff, possibly, and working something out here. Is that
Mr. Chair, we have visited, and I believe Senator Carlson is too, and we are at an impasse so far, but it is my hope that they would move past that impasse and work on something. And that, you know, frankly, that's why I think Senator Carlson and I put this forward in hoping that might stimulate some kind of movement.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. This will be held over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. And again, sorry about your inconvenience, but hopefully we can get to the bottom of one way or the other. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I would hope members would read this letter thoroughly. If you get to the bottom paragraphs on the first page, it says here that in the DNR staff asked for help in securing land that they feared would be developed. It's fairly obvious that this was an agreement that Parks and Trails and DNR were working on together. And I mean, they did a contract for deed at 0% interest. I mean, they're not trying to take advantage of anybody here. They're just trying to get resolution. I think we all need to work on this. This is the state that's involved in this, and it's incumbent on us to try to find some resolution here.
I agree, Senator Scoy, and thanks for those comments. I don't think we can act as judge and jury here today, though, but certainly we can help work with it and hopefully come to some resolve. Okay, thank you. Next up, Senator Nelson. Senate File 1263, Minnesota Museum Grant Appropriation. And you have some folks with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for hearing Senate File 1263 today. And I'd also like to thank my co-authors. That would be Senator Scoy and Senator Pappas, as well as Senators Michelle and Senjum. And I know you have lots before you today, so I'll just be very brief. This is a request for a $1 million appropriation from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It's for a children's museum. We are working, and this request has two parts. The $1 million request is to the Minnesota Children's Museum with $700,000 going to the Rochester Children's Museum. The one thing I'll just mention to you is that what you all know is that children are our heritage. I think it's very appropriate and fitting that we would use our arts and cultural heritage money for our children, which truly are our heritage. Today I have two testifiers with me. On my right, I have Diane Crinson, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Museum. She'll talk a little bit about their organization. I'd like you to know that we're partnering with this very credible and experienced group, which I think is key when you start a new endeavor. And on my left next, you'll hear from Melissa Brinkman, who is the president of the Rochester Children's Museum. And she'll talk about why Rochester is a community that can certainly support this. And Mr. Chair, might turn it over.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. Diane Crisen, president of Minnesota Children's Museum. You should have, I see a brochure in front of you that just briefly highlights the projects that we're going to talk today. And I'm just going to first start with that introduction on the back page that does give a sense of the scope and scale of Minnesota Children's Museum. We are a museum that serves more than 400,000 visitors a year. We have a reach all the way across the state, with the minor exception of Lake of the Woods. With 86 of the 87 counties visiting the museum, 43 counties have school groups that come to the museum. So we're very proud of that statewide reach. We're proud of the national recognition that we have as a top-tier children's museum in the country. And what we're here to talk about today is, while we're proud of that statewide reach, we also recognize that the further the geographic distance from our museum in downtown St. Paul, the less frequently a child and a family can come to visit the museum. And so that our proposal to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is around exactly the purpose of that fund in increasing access to the arts, and that's what we're going to focus on. There's three projects as part of this $1 million request. I'm going to briefly highlight two of them before passing it on to Melissa to talk more deeply about the Children's Museum in Rochester and starting that up. So first of all, Minnesota Children's Museum received a $500,000 appropriation in the last biennium from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. With those resources, I have a visual here just to bring that to life. With that $500,000 appropriation, we have developed a traveling exhibit that's called Storyland, A Trip Through Childhood Favorites. We've acquired the licensing right to seven beloved children's books, Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, Tale of Peter Rabbit. I know it's probably hard to see from there. And what we've created is, this is an exhibit where children will literally step into the world of these books with their parents and discover, play, learn, and develop literacy skills at the same time, with a lot of adult messaging in there as well about how to help your child develop literacy skills. There'll be a large-scale exhibit that opens in September at the St. Paul Museum, and that will attract about 150,000 visitors, we estimate, and then a small-scale exhibit that takes three of these books and starts traveling around the state of Minnesota. We open on June 10th in Worthington, Minnesota. Then we'll go on to Elk River, and we'll be in Redwood Falls as well. Those are the first three locations. We have a request for proposal out to identify the next three locations for that. One component of our request, of the million-dollar request, is to continue this tour of it. So the first appropriation funded going to six cities. We'd like to continue that tour to three more cities after that. And again, this is a tour that would be open in each of those communities for about 3 to 4 months, free to the public, and an opportunity. We're partnering with early childhood, family education, libraries, and just different community-based organizations to get this out and around Minnesota. The second project, as part of our proposal, is to build on a project that we've started in the metro area here, where, upside down, again, another visual, where the Minnesota Children's Museum has partnered with three libraries in the metro area to transform the children's book area and install what we in the museum world call an exhibit, but call it, think about it, it's interactive learning environment, again, very focused on literacy. And it is some pictures here about how to, you know, have an exhibit, have a child, have an attraction for our libraries that we're seeing as increasing attendance at the libraries, and a learning environment for children that are focused around developing the six pre-emergent literacy skills. What we'd like to do as part of this bill is to install six of these environments throughout Minnesota. So we have six more of these. And we estimate that that would reach about 24,000 children and families each year ongoing. This would be a permanent installation. It's not a traveling like we talked about before. This would be a permanent asset into those libraries around the state from this exhibit. So lastly, the largest project in the bill is to open a children's museum in Rochester, Minnesota. And before I turn it over, I thought I'd answer, so why is Minnesota Children's Museum interested in Rochester, Minnesota? Well, first of all, it is the third largest city in Minnesota. It has the highest percentage of children under 5 years old. I think it's worthy to note that our neighbors to the east in Wisconsin sustain seven children's museums in cities that are smaller and have less children than Rochester. So I think it's Rochester is set up for a lot of success to have a children's museum. And, you know, we're just really excited by the opportunity. I think that this model of partnership that we're looking at is, I think, a really efficient, lower-cost way for us to be able to leverage our fixed assets. We already have purchased a financing system. We've already purchased a ticketing system. We have exhibits that we pay to have in storage. You know, how can we leverage those across a larger audience base by partnering in this way? So we're really excited to explore this model. We think that this could have application in other areas of arts and culture expansion for the state of Minnesota. So, and the other thing that Rochester has going for it is a very committed group of parents, business leaders, and city leaders who have been very interested in starting a children's museum. And so with that, I want to pass it on to one of those committed parents.
Ms. Brinkman, thank you.
Ms. Brinkman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Melissa Brinkman, and I am the chair of the Rochester Children's Museum, as well as a almost lifetime resident of Rochester. So I'm very excited and passionate about this opportunity to partner up with the Minnesota Children's Museum. In 2007, we, a committed group of parents, decided to start this endeavor, and excited to still be a part of it. We did officially we incorporated with the 501c3 in 2007 with the intent to open a children's museum. So through that effort, we've been working over the last year with the Minnesota Children's Museum, where we signed a memorandum of understanding to explore the opportunity to open a satellite museum. Why Rochester? Again, the fact Rochester is a growing community, has a lot of young families, has over 2.7 million visitors that come, thanks in large part to the Mayo Clinic, that we don't have any real cultural attractions for children. And this is really something that we see as a void in the community to both sustain growth within the community as well as additional things for people to do when they come, whether it's for medical care or other purposes. We have a large sports sports commission that brings over 20 tournaments to town, additional things that they provide for youth, for them to be able to do things outside of the sports events is really key. One factor is that we've been talking about for a couple of years within Rochester is destination medical community and wanting to become the premier destination medical community in the world. And Mayo has been looking at that and partnering with various leaders and community, engaging the community with that, as they recognize over 70% of the time that patients and their families come to Rochester is spent outside of the walls of Mayo. And so what we can be doing as a community to help that. They are a huge economic engine, not only to Rochester, but to the state of Minnesota, as they reported out to the community last Wednesday. They reported that over $9.6 billion brought into the state of Minnesota. So what we can be doing in Rochester to additionally capture some people and find other things for them to do, education in different ways outside of the walls of our schools. Young children need the literacy and the help to get things started in a fun way for them to learn where they're not even realizing that they're learning and can engage in different ways. So we're very excited about what the Minnesota Children's Museum does up here and are very privileged to be able to be looking at this partnership with them.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. Brinkman, I'm just wondering how far along the planning is. Is the site been selected in that? At this point, or
Mr. Brinkman?
The site has not been selected yet. No.
So this funding is to help get it off the ground at this point?
Right. I meant to say that the legacy funding, thank you for asking that question, the legacy funding will go towards initiating the opening and operating a 5,000-square-foot museum, which we found to be a successful size. In fact, the Minnesota Children's Museum started in that same way over 30 years ago. So that would be what the dollars would go towards, is to open a kind of a startup museum.
Okay. Right. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crisen mentioned that there are several museums in Wisconsin and cities that are smaller than the size of Rochester. And I was involved in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program for a number of years as a big brother. And one of our most favorite trips was to the Children's Museum in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is not too far from Rochester. So I think this would be a great addition to southeastern Minnesota, and I thank all three of you for bringing this forward, especially Senator Nelson. I think this would just be great for southeastern Minnesota, and especially the Rochester community, as you mentioned with Mayo Clinic. It just seems like a perfect fit.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, members, we had a great talk yesterday about people who had gone to Como Zoo and the Minnesota Zoo with their grandchildren, and I encourage you, if you haven't already, to visit the Children's Museum in downtown St. Paul, just up the block from here. It's a fabulous addition to downtown St. Paul. It's been down there now 20 years?
15 years at this site.
15 years, right.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, some of us don't have grandchildren yet, so we have to take care of little brothers.
Senator Pappas, you beat me to it, actually. I've been all over with the grandkids, and that's one of the places I've been, and it's a great place. So I appreciate the presentation. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Nelson.
I could just have a couple of closing comments. Again, thank you for your consideration. I would urge that you include this in your funding appropriations. And I'll just say this is like a trifecta, isn't it? I mean, it is really a project that's got all those three elements that are so important. It's talking about our children, which is truly our heritage. Talking about literacy. We've talked a lot in this Senate about literacy and how important that is for education. And so that's part of the project. That's great. I can't wait to visit those story boards myself. And it's a leveraging opportunity. Working a new museum, working with a well-established expert in that area. So, again, thank you for your time. And
with that, Senator Nelson, Senate File 1263 will be held over for possible inclusion into the bill. Thank you. Senator Rod Skoy. Senate File 1294, Indian Language Preservation Education Appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I am here with Senate File 1294. And this is an effort to continue our state's work in preserving our native languages. And obviously, preserving the language is important for our culture, heritage. But there are some side benefits that this program is having for our state. It's moved into the schools, doing a great job with some of the young kids that are staying in school, and it's been instrumental, I'm sure, in keeping some of these young people interested in education and staying in the system to receive that valuable part of their skills. The other area where I think that we're going to see some gains with regard to the culture and the language of our Indian communities is with some of the folks as they work to improve their life after they've been through some of our correction facilities. There's a tremendous effort going on to include the American Indian culture, these facilities, and language is a very important. But besides the preservation of the language, this is bringing a lot of benefits to consultants in the would ask you to look favorably upon this request. I'm here with Joe Lynn from the Indian Affairs Council. I'm going to let her introduce herself because I'm not going to mispronounce her last name again. So I would like to turn this over to Joe Lynn, Indian Affairs Council, and she will talk about the efforts that received in the last go around and some of the plans they have for the future of this.
Senator Scoia, you said there were some dollars the last go around. I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee, Michigan. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jolynn Shoptees. I'm the Legislative Grants and Communications Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And I also have Pete Palma, and I'll let him introduce himself before I get started.
My name is Pete Palma with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council with the Cultural Resource Department.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had asked about our appropriation last year, and what we are asking for is exactly the same appropriation that was appropriated to us last year. First, I want to talk a little bit about our department. As Senator Scoia mentioned, we are the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. We were created in 1963, and our board is actually the tribal chairs of our tribal nations in Minnesota, as well as some of our commissioners and also some of our legislators. We convene four times a year, and it's a really great place for dialogue about the most important issues that are going on within the state and within our tribes. A little bit about what was done with the money last year. We were appropriated $550,000 and then $700,000 to grant out for Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization. We were given 9 months to put together a grant review board, to put together the RFP, to send the RFP out, to choose the winners of the grant, to write the contracts, to encumber the money, and to grant the money out. And I'm very pleased to say that we were able to do that. The majority of granting foundations are put together for 2 years before they even grant out a single penny. And it wasn't our office. It wasn't that our office is full of great employees. It's because we had great partners at the table. And it is because of our partners we were able to grant out that money. What you have before you are two handouts. The first handout is just a little bit more information about our office. In the very back of that handout, it actually has all the organizations that we granted out money to, as well as a little bit about the projects that were funded, how much they requested, and how much they were funded for. So there's a little bit more information about the grants that were given. The grants funded programs such as a language village up at Concordia College. It funded language revitalization all over the state of Minnesota. The second thing that we were appropriated money for is to do a feasibility study on Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization. And that is the second handout you have in front of you in the report cover. It is 40 pages, and it is full of incredible information about the state of our languages in Minnesota. Currently, we have less than 8 people in this state that are first speakers of the Dakota language. And these people are not young. They are getting older. I think the youngest person is in their late 60s, early 70s. And once these people pass on, our language of Dakota will be dead. And so we're at a real turning point where we need to do something, and we need to do something fast. So what we found in that report is there are a few reasons why our languages are dying. One is that, number one, our speakers are getting old. Number two is our languages of Dakota and Ojibwe, they were never meant to be written down. They're oral languages. And when you have an oral language, it's not like you can go to the library and pick up a book and pick up the curriculum. All of our curriculum needs to be created. Right now, there's no commercial immersion curriculum available, and so it needs to be written. What we found is that the best way to revitalize our language is by immersion schools. There are 2 immersion schools in Minnesota. One is on the Leech Lake Reservation. It's called the Bugganegijik School. And the other one is in Minneapolis, and it's the Wachoye, and I never say it right, Nandakitagan School. And so the third thing we were funded for is a pass-through to those 2 immersion schools so that they can continue their work. And what they did is they worked on creating language curriculum. They worked on getting teachers in the classroom, and they worked on training other teachers. How do you teach immersion? Immersion is so much different than regular school because you have one person who speaks the language and only the language that you're teaching. So those are the things that we were funded for last year, and we're asking to continue the work that we've been doing. We have a long way to go. The feasibility study was created by a volunteer working group. Those people were from all over Minnesota. We met once a month, even twice a month. These people gave up their time away from their family because this is their passion. They were not paid to do this, but this is their passion. And I do continually thank them so much for everything that they've done. But if you do look at the feasibility report, what we have are the reasons why our language is dying. What we don't have is a plan of how we can revitalize our language, and that's what we need. And so we're asking for an additional funding so we can continue the work of that working group. We really need a 25-year plan so we can look at it and strategically decide what we're going to be funding in our grants and what's the best way to truly revitalize our languages in Minnesota.
Thank you, members. Any questions? I have one question. On page 20 of your handout, Directive 9, can you explain what you're doing there on the top of the page, identifying current state and federal laws, regulations, and policies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of the things, when the feasibility report legislation was written, it was written in a way where they put together, let's put all these 10 mandates into the legislation, thinking that not all of it would be in the final legislation. Fortunately or unfortunately, all of it was in there. And so what this one looked at was, were there any laws on the state or federal books that completely prohibit language revitalization? And it was a question that we didn't know the answer to. What we did find is there really currently are no laws that are prohibiting language revitalization. Instead, there are policies within the Department of Education that prohibit language revitalization. For example, and I'll just give you a brief example, and I definitely do not work for the Department of Ed, and I don't see anyone in here. One of the examples is you cannot be in a classroom alone with students if you are not a licensed teacher. Well, as I said before, most all of our first speakers are elderly, they're our elders. And so for them to, at the age of 70, 80, 65, go back to school and become a licensed teacher is not a reality. It's not going to happen. So those are some of the things that we found looking at those. We didn't know, Mr. Chair, if there were any laws that would absolutely prohibit it. So that was one thing that we wanted to investigate.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have another presenter?
I don't know. Do you want to say something?
She just has said it all for
she
me.
She said it all.
I have nothing more.
Members, any questions? Senator Kielesch.
Yeah, just wondering, is this work being done in other states or Canada that will help move this process along?
Sure. Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. Montana is a state that has really gone far and wide in their language revitalization efforts. In other countries, the Maori language has definitely been revitalized. One thing we did talk about and obviously decided against it was to take a trip to these places and see how exactly did they revitalize their language. It was a nice conversation to dream about taking a beautiful trip to Hawaii and looking at what they did, but no, we did not do that. But if that's something you guys would like to fund, we would love to hear that.
I'll go. Follow up?
Yeah, just to follow up. I was more interested in is there curriculum developed there or other learning tools that were, instead of creating them here, we can purchase or whatever? And just the relationship if we're taking advantage of that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, they're actually different languages. So we could not take, let's say, the curriculum that is being taught in Hawaii and implement it here.
I was thinking more like, South Dakota or someplace with similar. I realize there's different tribes.
Sure, absolutely. And Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, we could look at the curriculum, but there are different state standards that come into play. So absolutely we can look at it as a guide of what can be done as far as taking curriculum in South Dakota or another state and implementing it here probably isn't feasible given the different
Is that much different?
Standard.
Okay.
Well, a good gauge of that is like South Dakota, if you go to the west regions of South Dakota, you have the Lakota people, and then further, when it would be east, you have the Dakota people, and their languages differ of the same nation.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Scoy.
While I would appreciate favorable consideration, I think it's important work that's being done, and I would like the folks to be able to continue this language preservation for the state of Minnesota. And, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members.
Senate File 1294, Senator Scoy, will be held over for possible inclusion in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas. Senate File 1304.
Good afternoon. We have some handouts here, Mr. Chairman, if the page could come and get them. Mr. Chairman and members, this request today has to do with civic education funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and it's to expand the great work started by three organizations with funds provided during the 2010 biennium. The three civic organizations, they're part of a coalition, is Kids Voting Minnesota, the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation, and an organization we all should be very familiar with, the YMCA Youth and Government Program, because when they have their conference here at the legislature, we all have to stay out of the chamber while the kids are there taking over. During the past 2 years, these three groups reached more than a quarter of a million Minnesotans, and they're requesting $500,000 for 2012-2013 to reach even more. This funding comes at a critical time. People are not born with the knowledge to be good citizens, and we all know that we just don't have enough civic education in our curriculum in our schools. A lot of times kids will graduate not really understanding the basic tenets of democracy or the basic structures of our political systems, the importance of voting, which we all understand as elected officials so much. If we don't take steps to preserve the civic heritage we inherited from past generations, we might not be able to pass it on to future generations. We should look at democracy as a little bit more fragile than it is and build into our young people more knowledge and more understanding and more appreciation. So the work of these groups is critical. It's an important investment. And to tell you a little bit more in detail, besides the handout, I have Jennifer Bloom from the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation, first of all.
Ms. Bloom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Actually, I'm going to hand it off to Tracy. She's
Sorry, we're starting with Tracy Warnberg-Lem from Kids Voting, and she is here, not Lars.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, you here today.
I'm sorry. Please identify yourself. Thank you.
Oh, yep. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Wernberg-Lem, and I work with Kids Voting. And we are here as members of the Minnesota Civic Coalition, which is made up of individuals and organizations committed to preserving Minnesota's heritage by passing on civic knowledge, traditions, and responsibilities to the next generation. The 2010-2011 Arts and Cultural Heritage Funding has allowed for many great organizations to preserve the diverse heritage in our state. One common heritage that we all share, that we are very passionate about, is our common civic heritage. Minnesota's strong civic heritage can be seen in our high voter turnout, our strong levels of volunteerism, our clean and open elections, and our good governance. This is the heritage that unites all of us. In 2005, we formed the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition because we have learned that the needs in civic education are vast and our abilities to address them are limited. By working together, we can create greater efficiencies and improve the civic knowledge and skills for more young people throughout our state. Through the last biennium funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, three members of the coalition with more than 90 years of civic programming experience provided a variety of civic education opportunities that we would not have otherwise been able to do. These funds were distributed to the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation, the YMCA Youth and Government Program, as well as Kids Voting Minnesota. Through our collaborative efforts, we reached over 250,000 Minnesotans. Our programming involves getting students to authentic places of civic learning, such as the Capitol, the Judicial Center, as well as the voting booth. Throughout the last 2 years, we've worked with many organizations, including the Minnesota Bar Association, their education committee, the City-County Managers Association Civic Education Committee, many veterans organizations, the Supreme Court Historical Society, the History Center, the Judicial Branch, and many elected officials like yourselves to support and enhance student learning. We reach out to kids in schools and meet them where they're at, and we also come beside and support teachers in their efforts to improve civic education through instruction and curriculum, through student opportunities, and through professional development. Today we are seeking continued funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to expand our civic education efforts. We are asking for the same amount of money that we received during the last biennium, and that amount is reflected in the current house plan. Cultural heritage refers to the cultural legacy inherited from previous generations, a legacy which we often want to identify and preserve because it reinforces our cultural identity and a sense of who we are as a people. Those of us in the Civic Education Coalition are extremely concerned about the decline in our collective civic knowledge. In fact, a few weeks ago, there was a Newsweek magazine article that referenced this, and the title was, "How Dumb Are We?" I don't know if you guys caught this, but it talked about, you know, almost 40% of Americans don't pass the citizenship test and know the basic tenets of government. So those of us in our coalition are very concerned about that. And there is a saying that one generation plants a tree and the next generation enjoys its shade. And when Minnesotans passed this heritage amendment, it was clear that they wanted to invest in preserving what matters to people of the state. They wanted to invest in the next generation. And Minnesota's civic heritage is what passed the 2008 Heritage Amendment and what really makes Minnesota special. So we wanted to just quickly go over some of our accomplishments and future plans with you. And they're highlighted on this green sheet that you have. I'll just kind of quickly go over kids voting. We had 42,000 students participated in a Youth Honor a Veteran program, and there was a website set up devoted where families could go and get ideas, and many young people submitted tributes to veterans in their lives and wore buttons to vote in honor of a veteran. Many of those testimonies will be printed in a new student version of the Minnesota Legislative Manual. There are over 400 students in Northeast Minnesota learned about a political candidate forum, and they participated in the Minnesota Secretary of State candidate debate in Thief River Falls, and 9 school districts participated in that and came from about 50 miles away, some of the students, and the students brought their questions to that. We have a number of Northwest Minnesota school candidates. We had 12 school districts that received subgrants to develop and conducted special events honoring veterans and connecting veteran services with voting and our responsibilities as citizens. And the 2010 election, we had more than 180,000 students participated in democracy directly by voting at the polls. I'm going to turn over to Jennifer.
So you said, I just wanted to interrupt for a minute, yeah. Mr. Chairman, because you set up polling booths like right next to the regular polling booth. So when parents come in with their kids can also vote.
Yep. Senator Pappas, this has been around for some time, I think. You told me, or your testifier said, Minnesota Bar and the Judicial, as well as county auditors. Did you work with county auditors in doing this at all with election? County auditors are your election.
Not with kids voting directly with that. They're partners for other programs that we did with another organization.
Okay.
So, and Jennifer can tell us.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Jennifer Bloom, and I'm the director of the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation. And in answer to the question, one of the things that we've been doing over the last couple of years is working with the local government officials and trying to create interactive, engaging lessons for students to learn about local government. One of the things that we are proposing to do next year is to actually create about 30 lessons on local government. We have been told by a number of folks that there's a great need for people willing to run for local office, whether it's school board or local government office. So our hope is we'll start them learning about the local government and how it operates, and they'll step to the plate and run for office when they get settled as adults. Learning Law and Democracy Foundation has been around for about 30 years. We actually were called the Minnesota Center for Civic Education at one point. And one of our claims to fame is the mock trial competition. We created that, the state competition and the national competition, and passed that off to the Bar Association when it became too large for us. So we've worked in partnership with the Bar for some time. Highlights of our last year included a launch of a new website. And for many people, they kind of go ho-hum about that, but our website really is designed to deliver high-quality lessons to teachers in the classroom. Textbooks cost an enormous amount of money, and teachers can't buy them. So we have teachers dealing with very old textbooks, and they go to the Internet. Well, the Internet, if you can imagine, sometimes has valid, accurate lessons and oftentimes not. So one of the things we're doing is taking lessons that have been created by Minnesota teachers. They've been vetted. They are correct. We have lawyers involved making sure that they describe the law accurately. It's on a searchable database, and we will continue to add more lessons to that. This next year, we want to add a section for the public, because as the citizens started seeing the lessons available for kids, they wanted to know, where is the stuff for the public? So we'll have a section there just for public resources. It's a portal to all things civic, is what we kind of think of it. We also expanded our programming, added another 240 students this year with the legacy funding, and mostly it helped teachers come to our programs. Transportation money is not available in the school, so we heard from teachers from rural Minnesota who said they could not come, and we paid for buses for them. We also targeted particular audiences, one of which was kids in corrections. They need to learn about being a good citizen, so we actually got them involved in our programs. We work with teachers to improve their education, their quality of their teaching. Next year, we want to add another 350 teachers and expand to new audiences. These things all were possible from the legacy funding and would not have happened without it. Because our representative from our Youth and Government YMCA program is not here, I wanted to highlight a couple of things for you, because you know about the program, but what you probably don't know about is what Legacy funded last time. They created a conference for young people to deal with Minnesota issues. So the students came together, learned from experts in the field, and in the description on the back side of the page, it describes the issues they were talking about. They targeted the pilot program, they call it YCSI, the Conference on State Issues, and they targeted 30 students last time. They came from kids in challenging communities, and this year they're tackling higher education. If you notice on point two, their impact was interest in state issues before the conference was 14.9%, and after it rose to 62.8%. That's,
okay.
I think.
All right. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chairman, that's all we have. This is one of our few opportunities to really impact civic education in a big way, because we can leverage a lot of private support with the legacy dollars as well, and reach a lot of kids for a very kind of memorable and worthwhile experience that will stay with them all their lives.
We hope that's true. That's great.
Make them better citizens.
That's right.
Better participants. Better constituents for us.
Senator Pappas, Senate File 1304 will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
You very much.
Thank you.
Senator Vanderveer. Senator Vanderveer, welcome to the committee. You have before you Senate File 128, and along with some guests.
Do, Mr. Chair, but before we start, could somebody move the A1 amendment, which would get the bill in the...
It's coming around, members, the A1 amendment.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kielash moves the A1 amendment. Could you explain that to us, Senator, while it's being handed out?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, what the A1 amendment does is conforms the bill to what was adopted, what's currently in the same matchup bill in the House, and it adds a representative deal provision for $50,000 to the rest camp, the Veterans on the Lake Resort in on Fall Lake in St. Louis County, as to the bill which funds the improvements to the Big Marine veterans, the disabled vet camp on Big Marine Lake in May Township. So it's just conforming it to where the House is at with this.
Members, any questions about the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this bill does is it allows funding for matching grants, so they have to match them, for improvements to this, to the veteran, the disabled vets rest camp, which is in May Township in my Senate district that I represent. And here, just to talk about what the purpose of these grants would be for, is Lori Alness, who's on the board of directors. She'll start out and tell us a little bit about the camp.
Welcome. Alness, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lori Alness, and I'm a veteran having served 25 years in the military. I'm on the board of directors of the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp representing the American Legion. I understand that the committee was provided a handout summarizing some information on the camp, and I'd like to point out 4 points. First, the camp has seen a surge of visitors. In the last 3 years alone, the amount of visitors to the camp has increased every year by an additional 2,000 visitors. This year, the camp is expecting over 12,000 visitors. Among those visitors will be people like me and my family who go there to be with others who have also experienced the challenges of military duty. The camp will be especially important to me and my daughter, while my husband, Colonel Eric Alness, will soon be deployed for a year in Afghanistan. Need like this has required upgrading and expansion of the 85-year-old camp. Second, the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp is the only yellow ribbon camp in the United States, accepted by both the military and the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is the nation's leader for encouraging businesses, churches, entire communities to be yellow ribbon, and the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp recognized it was important to partner with these many public and private entities to care for our veterans. Third, many of the campers and visitors to the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp have come from out of state, some even staying the entire summer. This becomes a tremendous amount of veterans here in Minnesota, which is an economic benefit to the community and to Minnesota as a whole. Lastly, the camp is recognized by the public as being a successful reintegration venue for all veterans, and we've had many, many organizations step forward to offer their assistance to upgrade and expand the camp. To date, much of that assistance has been in the form of donated time and labor. The time and later donated to build the camp's new yellow ribbon pavilion and 12 handicap accessible cabins alone totaled over $500,000. Now these cabins need to be finished, furnished, and landscaped before they can safely be rented out. And to provide additional safety, a combined shelter and shower house needs to be constructed, and the materials for these projects must be purchased by the camp. Therefore, we respectfully ask that a $450,000 matching grant be approved to continue the 85-year tradition of the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp, taking care of veterans and their loved ones. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Allness. The question I have, where are you on the matching grants now? Maybe you testified to that already. Have you raised those dollars?
Mr. Chair, these...
Senator.
This is prospective.
Right. Mr. Chair, at this point, we're told that the time frame is open where we have to wait, basically.
The camp does have a history, Mr. Chair, if I could, of raising money. They've raised, I think, I don't have a total, but I know that they have raised probably hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have some major businesses, some construction supply businesses that donate to them, and they've had donations from labor, the cement people, the IBEW, I believe, is
Anderson Foundation.
Anderson Foundation. And I think Mr. Mitchell's going to talk about that, but the donations have been unbelievable. Anyway, let's let Alice tell.
Mr. Mitchell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name's Al Mitchell, the disabled combat veteran from the Vietnam conflict. I presently serve as president of the board representing Washington County, which the board is made up of several members from different organizations, the Legions, the VFW, the DAV, and Ramsey County and Washington County. And that makes up our board. In 2009, we had $51,000 in donations that was given to the camp from outright donations from different organizations. We had something in the neighborhood of $325,000 in labor donated to us through the 110 Union of St. Paul, Electrical Union, the IBEW, the masonry workers out of Minneapolis, and bricklayers. Last year we had a similar amount, $300,000 donated us by the Minnesota National Guard that used their AT period for their annual training for 2 weeks for the last 2 years to help build additional cabins for us. Of course, we had the expense of have to supply the material. And that's where we're at again at this point is the material. It's really hard to build this stuff at $100 a crack from a VFW that's having trouble, or a Legion that is made up of a bunch of veterans that are just trying to survive. And so we are actively going after grants, the Anderson Foundation, a few others that we've been very blessed to have come forward with money. And now we're asking the state to help us a little bit with this matching grant that if you can so find it in your way to do this matching grant, we will find the other part of the money and get that $1 million or the $500,000 we need for this shower house. It's very important we have this for the veterans. I come from the era where I got off the plane in San Francisco and I had to take my uniform off and travel the rest of the way across the country to my next duty assignment because I was ashamed to say I was a soldier. And I just came back from combat. I still carry the wounds from that, and I know a lot of other members do too. Am I bitter about it? Yes, but that's in the past. I get over it. But this place is a place I can get over it. There's so many veterans that come up there that's their sanctuary. They turn on that dirt road, and they enter a whole different world. And that's what we want to continue giving them, to bring their families to reconnect and be part of the society again and be proud of the fact that they're a veteran. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much for that testimony, and we certainly thank both of you for your service. Senator Kielesch.
Could you indulge me a little bit? Mr. Chair, I've been with the Carpenters Union, and I've been to the camp, and I believe the building I was working on at the time was the Park Pavilion.
That's correct, yes. The
Carpenters did a lot of work. And that's several years ago, and at that time, the camp needed a tremendous amount of work and maintenance. And so my question is, how far along have you gotten? And it seems like some of these new buildings have added to the visits that you've got as well. So could you just give us an update on how well you're doing so far?
Certainly, Senator.
Mr. Mitchell.
The handout that was given to you a three-page handout here. It kind of explains some of that, but I'll just walk through some of the key points on it, if you don't mind. One of them is the fact that we've expanded to 120 RV sites from the 25 that was about 15 years ago. We expanded the tent sites from just the 15 or 20 that we had to 30, and we want to expand it more. We put in a hiking trail. We've expanded the cabins from the 11 that we had to 24. And that was the help of the National and National Guard. We put in a beautiful pavilion that, with the help of the carpenters and electricians and the masonry and the bricklayers and everything, and the 49ers that came out there and donated all the earth moving, and we put in a pavilion that can seat 300 people for the different functions that we have that come up there and they use it. And so, and it's starting to be used quite regularly. We've had barbecue grills donated to us. We've had TVs that Patriot Riders donated for all the cabins for us and everything. So it's really, it's come a long way in just 15 years as far as what it can do. We've expanded our docks, we've tripled the size of our docks thanks to the help of Washington County, the DNR, and the Watershed District people allowing us to be able to expand that and offer it to our veterans. So there's many things we do, and a lot of the veterans are coming, and younger people are coming and want to use it. And but we're having a few problems with it because of the fact that it is new. And so just like anything else, we have to promote it, and that is a problem of the board that we're trying to address at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and that is that this was a going concern, and it started to slip, I think, in quality just from lack of money for maintenance. And the group started finding funds and volunteers to help turn this around, had big plans, and it sounds like you're moving forward with those plans, and it's just going to keep getting better. So so I think this is one of those things that is a good investment for our for this committee. So thank you.
Ms. Solis, if you wanted to add something, Mr. Chair, if she could.
Mr. Chair, if you were asking what are we doing to also to go forward, I want to mention that the board of directors, like Mr. Mitchell said, it's made up of volunteers that represent disabled American veterans, American Legions, VFWs, et cetera. And one of the things we're trying to do is get the word out to these younger troops. And we recently had someone from a marketing department come in and volunteer his time and give us some information about how we can do that, how we can get the word out to young veterans, as well as how we can get the word out that we are nonprofit. And I'm personally sitting on right now, someone asked what are we doing to get those matching grants, I'm sitting on 800 letters, and I've donated, you know, the stamps and the stationery and everything, and it's going to every single service veteran organization in Minnesota. So as soon as a capital campaign to say, you know, as soon as we get this, hopefully, that we're asking for their support.
Thank you.
Members, any further questions? Senator Vandiver, any final comments?
Mr. Chair, other than to say that this really would show appreciation for what our veterans have done, and they value this, and I would invite any of you, it's not very far from here, we can take a run up anytime you want and take a look at it. Senator Kalish, get an update. I think you'd be extremely impressed at how dollars that we've invested have been used so far. So, Pat, I know you're busy, and I'll just thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senate File 128, Senator Vandiver, will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again for your service.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have before you Senate File 158. Would you please introduce that to us?
Members, thank you. Senate File 158, the Outdoor Heritage Appropriation. This actually came through our committee probably an awful long time ago, actually. This was introduced to this committee a couple months ago. And at this time, what my intentions to do are to
to combine this part of the heritage appropriation, Lassard Outdoor Heritage appropriation, with the clean water appropriation. And what we will do later, just through the information of the process, we will also be combining the other two portions. When those get completed, of course, the heritage dollars we've been talking about the last two nights, the arts and humanities as well as the parks will be combined at a later date. But today it's just to combine the two bills. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I have the lead all amendment, and I'll have Mr. Knopf take us through the workings of that.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and members. That's the A6 amendment. Is that correct, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
And that amendment is in your packet, members.
Mr. Knopf. Mr. Chair and members, before I get into the details here, what I wanted to also state was to add on to what Senator Ingebrigtsen said, that one of the reasons for doing this is because so this bill can get referred to the State Government Innovations and Veterans Committee, because there are some issues that have to be heard by that committee, so that tomorrow you'll be putting together a committee bill that will have all four pieces, and these two pieces are going to travel separately for now to go to the State Government Innovations and Veterans Committee. I just want to make sure people understood the process. Mr. Chair and members, I'm not going to go over every part of this bill because the committee's heard Senate File 158 and heard Senate File 657. But I will go through some of the differences between this and what was heard just quickly. Some are fairly technical, but I want to point out a couple of them. On 2.12 to 2.15, there's money that was for monitoring and enforcement, and now this actually has a dollar amount associated with the monitoring enforcement up to that dollar amount. And there are several places where there are monitoring and enforcement funds that are established for monitoring these easements. And in those places, instead of just money, we've put dollar amounts, and I've worked with the staff from Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council for that. And then, Mr. Chair, members, I think we'll go all the way back to subdivision 17, which is on page 25. And what this is, again, working with staff from the council, what this is past appropriations where there was money that was appropriated for monitoring enforcement, but it was never mentioned. And there's some, I was raising some issues last summer as to whether or not that was a proper way to do it. So this kind of fixes it up and makes sure that the money can be appropriately used for that process. So that's what subdivision 17 is. That's, again, new from when you saw this last. Otherwise, up to that point in the bill, it's the same now. We will get to a few differences here. If you look on page 27, the bottom of page 27, where, again, 27.33, this is amended to bring in to bring in terms to make sure that, to clarify that the terms of the council are also as provided in 15.0575. That's the standard for this. Before, it didn't mention terms, and there was some lack of clarity as to whether or not that applied. And then, Mr. Chair and members, on 28.5, you can see this is statutory language now. And this would say it upon coordination with the Legislative Coordinating Commission rather than approval. That's pretty standard. It's similar language to what's used with the Lassard, with the LCCMR, and this would bring that into conformance with that. And then, Mr. Chair and members, there's a deleted sentence starting on 28.18. That says that the council shall consider a range of options and shall not adopt definitions, restore, protect, or enhance that would limit the council from considering options. So basically, it was trying to take away some flexibility. This was adopted last year. And then on 29.20 to 29.21, those are just technical changes. And another significant change is in section 6. Where this would now change the open meeting law for the council to be the same as the LCCMR, all of the legislative bodies, including the House and Senate, rather than using the local government law. There have been some issues and concerns over how this the current law would work. with the council, and you can see on 29.34 striking receive information or. So it's when they take action, the same as any other legislative body. Again, these are in the legislative. This is a legislative entity. It's considered in the legislative branch. And then that would mean that the last sentence on 30.3 to 30.5 would not be needed anymore. And this also would line it up with the changes in the bill creating the new Clean Water Council. It would be similar language. And then in 30.9 to 30.14, there are some changes related to the legislative auditor. It removes the every 2 years. Again, this would be comparable to the LCCMR and other entities where it's the auditor uses the auditor's discretion on how often they're done. And then also there's some language being stricken. Instead of repeating the constitutional language, this would kind of broaden it to say in compliance with all applicable law in the Constitution. These are financial audits and not program audits. And so there was some concern about how the wording was before, and this would change that. In 30.22 to 30.25, there's a notice requirement when the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council is to make a decision. This removes that notice requirement. There are already conditions on how the council is supposed to approve those when they're approving a purchase of land that is in public domain. Section 9 makes some. Well, the first change on 30.27 is technical. 30.28, changing the shall to may. Would better reflect when there's money for this purpose, then they would convene one of these panels. Same with 31.14. And on 31.8 to 31.10, again, the seed language that's been removed from this bill and from LCCMR and others would mean the Native Vegetation Establishment Enhancement Guidelines were based on that language, and since the language is being deleted, this would not be needed anymore. So those are the significant changes, Mr. Chair and members, to Article 1 from what you had seen earlier. And then, Mr. Chair, I think what I'll do is I'll move on to Article 2. There are probably fewer changes. There was a delete everything amendment that you looked at a couple of weeks ago, two weeks ago. And this is basically the same as what you saw. The one difference is, again, on the audit language. There was an audit language similar. If you look on 53.21 to 53.23, there was language similar to the Lasard Sams that used the constitutional language. And what this does is then reflect the basically in compliance with all applicable law and the Constitution. So otherwise, that section is the same as before. Again, I can take questions on any parts, but I don't want to waste your time going over the same things we went over it a couple of weeks ago. And then on page 54, section 21, each of the three outdoor funds, anyways, had this restoration evaluation language attached to it, identical language. So this makes identical changes to the restoration evaluation language for the Clean Water Fund. And, Mr. Chair, I think I'll stop there because that's basically the differences between what the committee had seen in previous versions of both bills and what's in the delete all amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. And Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A6 amendment. Any further discussion or questions for Senator Ingebrigtsen or Mr. Knopf on the A6 amendment? Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf, would you go back to page 30, please?
Mr. Knopf.
Looking at the striking of some notice language, notice of doing something and that's being deleted. So what would if this is deleted, what would then the public notice requirements be for whatever this is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council has to hold a public meeting. They have all the public notice requirements that are required for any other entity. So there would be public notice. This was specific notice to the Legislative Coordinating Commission as opposed to blanket public notice. The public notice would still be there. It just wouldn't have to have a specific notice to Lasard or to the LCC. Generally, the notice requirement is 3 days.
Thank you.
Members, other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair, if I could, and members, just for information, tomorrow when we bring and combine all four of the bills, we'll take amendments and testimony at that time. So.
Senator Kielash?
Mr. Chair, I know you got the financials here. One of the things we hadn't we talked about briefly, but I don't know if we've got an actual number. Do we have a PILT payment number on these Lasard Sams and Clean Water that is going to have to be passed on to the general fund?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I don't know if that. I mean, throw a curve at you, Senator.
Senator, thanks for that curve. Yeah, actually, as you probably remember, payment was taken from our committee and brought over to taxes. In fact, we just dealt with it on the floor the other day with regards to Senator Ortman's tax bill. Maybe I'm confused. Are you talking about setting aside some dollars for PILT? We had this discussion before, I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it was we couldn't. The courts ruled that we couldn't set aside the constitutional amendment funds for PILT payments, but we've been purchasing land, and I think in the last couple of years we're up to, I want to say, $430,000, and I'm not sure how much this adds to that PILT payment. And I'm just wondering if we had an idea on that.
I do have.
I'm
sorry, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I do have the Executive Director, Bill Beckerwith. He can give you some idea. I believe. I'll just not take a stab at the number here and let him go ahead and tell you what the obligation has been so far to this date. Just in this, as well as what's included in this new bill, and I think it's $175,000, but I'll let him.
Welcome, Mr. Becker, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Bill Becker, staff, Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. This will add approximately $175,000. It's hard to have a certain number.
Mm-hmm.
Could be as much as $195,000, depending on the actual value of the land purchased. And where it is.
Mr. Chair, follow
Mr.
up.
Mr. Kielash.
Is that just for the Lasard Sams money, or is that also for any money purchased by the...
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
That's just for the Lasard Sams acquisitions.
Senator Kielash,
Mr. Chair, do you know what the total is then for, since in the last, 3 years, that we've been purchasing property from Lasard Sam? What's the PILT payments been gone up to?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, our estimates have been in the $150,000 range. I can get you the exact numbers, but once again, they're estimates that are dependent upon what's actually purchased.
Mr. Chair, and just what I'm trying to get a hand, is that per year or that we've added per year? Because we've been purchasing land right along.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
If this recommendation is passed, the annual increment added to the PILT payment would be approximately $450,000 from all three recommendations.
Okay, thank you.
Other members, questions? Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, it should also be noted there's some acquisition in the first bill that we brought forward for LCCMR as well.
Mm-hmm.
There has been some acquisition going on there for some years. I don't know the PILT payment there. That we can certainly check on that for you if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, my concern is that we've been increasing that PILT payment with funds that are with one set of funds and another set of funds has to pay them, and it's something we need to be watching, I think. And I'm not sure this is the right time to do it, but I think we have to look at that as into the future here. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair, that's always, that's certainly the conversation that's going on and the concern that's going on with acquisition. The House is attempting to deal with it in their bill. You'll see that in due time, I guess. But it is an ongoing issue, and those are general fund dollars that have to pay those ongoing. And I think our ongoing obligation. And again, I'm going to take a stab here, but I think I shouldn't even take a stab. I guess I can't tell you what it is. Mr. Becker's rising out of his. The seat again for
PILT, total PILT right now.
For his expertise,
it's going to
answer.
Be 26.
Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chair, the total state obligation for PILT is approximately $22 million.
It's going up to 26 or 27.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Other comments or questions from the members, from the senators?
That would be
Senator
annually.
Scoy? Thank question?
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I just asked if that was an annual.
Other members, other questions? Hearing no other questions, we'll continue to vote on the A6 amendment. The A6 amendment, as you have heard, is amendment combining Senate File 158 and Senate File 657. All those in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment carries. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 158 as amended by the A6 amendment? There being no further discussion on Senate File 158 as amended, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion carries. The Senate File 158 will be referred to the State Government Innovations and Veterans Committee. Thank you, Mr. Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think we have anything else before the committee?
If nothing else comes before the committee, we will adjourn the committee of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources. And thank you very much.
Did we do the water follow-up?
We're going to go to midnight again.
Tomorrow.